Good morning, Justice Holland. May it please the Court, William Fletcher on behalf of the appellant, Rocky Staton. This matter comes before this Court to consider an issue, I believe, of first impression regarding activities of corporations under the Delaware general corporation laws. The basic issue is whether or not an action by an injured worker against the corporate successor of a third-party tortfeasor is precluded when the corporate successor is the worker's employer. What we have in this case is...
Mr. Fletcher, before you get into that part, what is the duty that you characterize the third-party tortfeasor as having to your client?
The duty, Your Honor, is the duty of any manufacturer, owner, operator of equipment to maintain that equipment, to inspect that equipment, and to not alter or modify it to render it unsafe or dangerous for use. And in this particular case, where particularly Polymer Color, which is the constituent corporation that merged into Clariant, its duty applies not only to its own workers at the time that they were using it, but when it is then transferring that equipment through the merger to be used by others, it knows that duty extends to those others. Mr. Staton was a foreseeable user of this equipment as an employee of the surviving corporation.
Well, I'm just trying to understand the implications of ruling in your favor, and I guess what you're contending is anytime any employee is on the job, their recourse against their employer is limited under the Workmen's Compensation Act. But to the extent they're using a wrench, a hammer, driving anything, they can still sue the third party that made the part they were using at the time of the injury.
If in fact, the that third party had created a defective piece of equipment that was going to be used, yes, Your Honor. Suppose a Polymer Color didn't simply merge, but rather simply sold its equipment to Clariant and continued on as a corporation, and the equipment it sold Clariant was defective and dangerous, and a worker using that equipment is injured due to that defect. I believe under Delaware law, that employee would certainly have a third-party claim against Polymer as the party responsible for creating and allowing others to use a dangerous and defective piece of equipment.
Even if it was sold as is?
Well, Your Honor, when you say even as it's sold as is, I believe that that raises an issue as to whether or not that could constitute a breach of warranty. That's an as-is is a phrase that's used in sales regarding warranties. Every owner of equipment that is going to send it to others, I believe, has a common law duty not to negligently provide others with defective equipment, simply for the safety of the users. And whether it was a large corporation supplying defective wrenches or whether it was Polymer, both of them had that duty to a foreseeable user such as Mr. Staton.
And how far into the future would that duty extend? Let's assume it was the equipment was modified 10 years earlier and then sold.
Well, Your Honor, under our law, I guess there might be two answers to that. One is, negligent claims don't arise until an injury occurs, notwithstanding when the negligent conduct creating an unsafe condition was created. It's a two-year statute from the time of injury. On the other hand, if you had a breach of warranty claim under our law, it's 4 years from the time of transfer or sale. And so something happening 10 years later, which causes an injury, would not be actionable under a breach of warranty claim, which is limited to the four-year period.
If the seller has sold, let's assume the seller maintained and altered the equipment in a negligent way and its own worker was injured, and then it sold the equipment to another company and that other company's employee was injured. So you have employee A being the original seller's employee and employee B being the buyer's employee. A and B would not come out the same under your rule, would they?
They would not, Your Honor. I mean, I think what
and
you're
why
in,
is that right?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, it's right in the sense that the fact that they don't come out evenly is due to the statutory scheme enacted by the legislature relating to workers' compensation benefits. Employer A, who would only have a claim against his own employer for workers' comp benefits, he would have the right to make a claim against any third party, but there are none. On the other hand, employee B, he has a right to get his workers' comp benefits from his own employer, but again, under the workers' comp statute, 2363, he's entitled to go and make a claim against that third party, which was the first corporation you mentioned. And in doing so, while the remedy may seem to be broader, I think it should be kept in mind that the employee, when he makes that third-party claim, does have an obligation to reimburse fully his employer for the benefits he received before he gets to receive anything. But that is due to the structure of the workers' comp statutes as seen fit by the legislature.
Is the legal position you're advocating the majority view in other jurisdictions or the minority view?
Your Honor, from my research, I believe it's the majority view. I do recognize that there are some courts that have not followed it, but the Billy versus Consolidated Machine Tool case from the Court of Appeals of the State of New York is the seminal case in this area. And there have been a number of cases since then that have followed it. And
When the First Circuit addressed this, the case cited by your opponent, they came out the other way saying that they were following the majority view. Is that simply more jurisdictions have come on later, or?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that's the Braga case from the First Circuit. And that's an unusual case, but I would mention that, first of all, as a federal court case, it is simply trying to apply what it believes and has an understanding as to what Massachusetts law is. We cite a case from Massachusetts Supreme Court that while Braga recognizes and talks about in its opinion, it doesn't really follow, and that's the Curry case, which we have cited, and I believe that the Aguri case is far closer to our situation than what went on in Braga. I believe while the court may or may not have wanted to emphasize this, it did note in Braga that the employee had an employment relationship with the predecessor corporations. And if that's the case, the surviving corporation is going to get the benefit of that defense. We are certainly in agreement that had Mr. Staten, for instance, ever been an employee of Polymer Color, and then there's the merger, under the corporation laws, the surviving corporation gets the benefit of any defense, any privileges, any immunities that Polymer Color had. And so had he been an employee of Polymer Color, he could not be presenting this claim now.
Let me just see if I understand this. The exclusivity statute, which, you know, either a defense available to the employer or an immunity from suit, basically provides that the exclusive remedy against an employer, in connection with an employment-related accident is workers' compensation. So there cannot be any independent tort claim asserted against the employer, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. In this particular case, when the tort claim was asserted against a non-employer, Polymer, and had there been no merger, we wouldn't be involved at all with the exclusivity provision of the workers' comp statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it so happens that there was a merger of Polymer into Clariant, which happens to be the employer of the plaintiff. But there is no tort claim being asserted against Clariant directly. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That is the only claim that's being asserted against Clariant, the employer, is in the employer's capacity as the acquirer through a merger of the non-employer.
Yes, Your Honor.
Tortfeasor. And so your argument is that under Section 259, the non-employer's liability is assumed as a matter of law by the employer, but the fact that the acquirer happens to be the employer is basically circumstance. It's happenstance. It doesn't bear any role in the analysis. That is, if the immunity created by the exclusivity provision didn't attach to the tort to the non-employer tortfeasor, it's not going to attach to the employer solely in its capacity as the acquirer through a merger of the tortfeasor.
Correct, that's our position. Yeah. And we hold that position, and the cases that we cite, beginning with the Billy case, follow that legal analysis that allows the claim that Mr. Staton is attempting to make against Clariant, not for Clariant's negligence, not for anything that relates to Clariant and Mr. Staton as employer, but because Clariant voluntarily chose to merge with another company, and it's the claims against that other company that we are seeking to assert in this present matter based upon 8 Delaware Code Section 259, which states that the surviving corporation assumes all responsibilities, duties, and liabilities of the constituent corporation that in effect becomes extinguished as a result of the merger. And there does not seem to be any limitation to the right and duty to assume this responsibility. The cases that we cite, almost all of them do deal with equipment, with machinery that is used in the workplace, in a plant, and that it was previously used, modified, even manufactured by third parties who then have been extinguished by a merger with the defendant named in the case. Again, to emphasize the balancing that goes on here.
Well, Mr. Fletcher, in the cases that appear to go the other way, are those cases that involved independent tort claims against the employer?
They do, Your Honor. As I mentioned, the Braga case has the very complicated fact pattern that the court states that the injured party was a worker or employee of the predecessors. And if that's the case, as it states in its opinion, then under Delaware law, there would be no claim there. So I think Braga is different.
What is your position as to the point that this merger effectively would increase, under your analysis, the liability of the predecessor company? Because the predecessor company had no intention for anyone to use this equipment other than the limited group of employees that it had. And by expanding it to potentially however number of employees there are in the acquirer, that's beyond the scope of their original contemplation.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that is really not a factor that should disallow this suit for the following reason. Suppose, rather than a merger, a polymer merely sold the defective equipment to Clariant and went on its way and continued its corporate activities. When the injury happens, the plaintiff would clearly be entitled to sue Polymer for its negligent conduct. And that's all that is happening here, except only because of the merger statute, the liability of two entities now are combined into one entity for responsibility purposes. And that's why I believe they call it, in some forums, this dual persona. It's not Clariant's obligations or responsibilities as an employer that's being questioned here.
Well, it's not being sued in its capacity as an employer.
It's not, Your Honor.
There's no, and there is no independent tort claim that is claim of tortious wrongdoing that's being asserted against the employer.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Therefore, there's nothing to preempt. That is, the workers' compensation exclusivity provision would not even come into play.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because there's nothing to exclude.
Yes.
Sure. So I assume there's no way that an inquirer can protect itself against this. If let's assume it has no idea that the predecessor has modified equipment in any way. There's nothing that can be done. You're just going to be, by virtue of the merger, you're liable for all those risks, known and unknown, that the predecessor or their conduct, whatever it might be.
I don't think it's as broad as that, Your Honor, in the sense that you still must prove a negligence claim, and the plaintiff still has that burden. We're before this court on a motion to dismiss, where the record below was never really developed. But there has to be a negligence claim. First of all, the acquiring company, at the time of a merger, can certainly take the opportunity to examine, evaluate, and determine the safetiness of the equipment, of the plant, and things of that
nature. You're talking about due diligence.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
You're talking about due diligence.
Yes, Your Honor.
As part of the pre-merger agreement conduct of the acquirer.
Yes, Your Honor. And that would certainly play a role in limiting, I would think, the potential exposure. But as the cases we cite indicate, Your Honor, you're dealing with work equipment that moves. Frankly, the work equipment itself may not move all that much, but you have different companies owning it at different times. They modify it, or they make changes to it, and then it causes an accident after a merger.
And if it after the merger, every new hire would have a claim, but if you were a former employee of the acquired company, you would not?
If you're a former employee of the acquired company and you were injured?
And you're still working for the acquirer, would you have a claim then?
No. I'm sorry, you would not have a claim, in this context, you would not have a claim against Polymer if you worked for Polymer and then you worked for Clariant and then you were injured on the job. And the reason you wouldn't have a claim against Polymer under that scenario is because, again, the corporate law 259 states that the acquiring company acquires all of the defenses or immunities that the constituent corporation had. And since as an employer-employee relationship between state and, in theory, and Polymer, that exclusivity protection would pass on to Clariant.
Okay, so you'd have eligible claimants who could bring a third-party claim and those who could not, depending on when they were hired.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, I would just say this goes to the structure and part of the workers' comp laws, because what you just stated to me, Your Honor, if you don't assume a merger, but just assume a sale of equipment, and Polymer goes on its way, the employee is still not going to be able to sue Polymer because he was an employee of Polymer. And that's because of the nature of the workers' comp law. He gives up that right against Polymer, to sue him as a tortfeasor because he was an employee. Whether he has a workers' compensation claim might be another matter, but I'm not here to really address that.
Mr. Fletcher, yes, you used up all of your time, including your rebuttal time.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. I suspect I'll have nothing further to say.
Mr. Connors.
May it please the Court, Kevin Connors on behalf of Clariant Corporation. Your Honor, and Justice Holland, I think the very first question that was posed to Mr. Fletcher is a key issue in this case. Your question was, what duty are you trying to define here? Section 259, as we know, basically states that the successor surviving a company to a merger acquires the defenses, immunities of its predecessor non-surviving company. However, it also acquires the duties of its predecessor company. And the cases that we have cited, I believe, are the majority view that a predecessor company such as Polymer Color owes no duty to a successor's employee. And there are no Delaware cases that stand
Excuse
for
me,
that
Polymer
proposition.
Is not the successor.
Pardon?
Polymer is not the successor. It's Clariant.
Right. Correct, Your Honor. Clariant is the successor. Polymer is the predecessor.
And Polymer was not an employer.
Correct, Your Honor.
Of the plaintiff, and therefore would not have a workers' comp exclusivity defense.
Absolutely.
Against any tort claim. Correct?
That's one facet.
Okay. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. If the day after the lawsuit, the tort lawsuit is filed against Polymer, there's a merger of Polymer into Clariant. And let's assume for the moment that Clariant is not the employer of the plaintiff. It's just an independent company. Again, all that would happen would be that Clariant assumes the assets and the liabilities of Polymer as a matter of law, a matter of statutory law.
Statutory law.
And the lawsuit could then proceed against Clariant, correct? I'm assuming Clariant is not an employer of the plaintiff.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So the only difference between that hypothetical and this case is that Clariant happens to be the employer.
That is a difference, Your Honor.
It's a difference. I don't know if it's a distinction, but it's also the case, is it not, that there is no tort claim, that is no claim that Clariant committed any independent tort against this plaintiff. That is, it's not being sued in its capacity as a tortfeasor.
I think that's not correct, Your Honor. I think that when you look at plaintiff's amended complaint, they attempt to allege a claim of a spoliation and
I thought the tort had to do with the maintenance of a piece of machinery or the improper maintenance of a piece of machinery. That's the claim against the acquired company, Polymer. Correct.
Failure to maintain an alteration.
All right. There is no such claim being asserted directly against the acquirer, Clariant. Is that correct?
That's correct, nor could there be.
Okay, the only capacity in which Clariant is being sued is as the acquirer of the alleged tortfeasor, Polymer, in its capacity, that is, in Clariant's capacity, as the surviving corporation in a merger. Is that correct?
Your Honor, not only in that capacity, but there's also claims, independent claims. I believe that they, if I invite the Court's attention to our argument on the statute of limitations, and
that's a defense. That's not a claim.
I understand, Your Honor, but Mr. Staten alleged in his amended complaint that Clariant Corporation spoliated evidence by replacing part of the concrete floor where the incident happened, and by misplacing an equipment log book, Now, they've alleged some affirmative actions that they believe is a basis for liability against my client, and that's...
Okay, so we can distinguish, can we not, between tort claims, that is, claims that are made directly against Clarion for acts that it did, which may or may not be immunized by the exclusivity provision, and acts that it's that the acquirer, the acquired corporation, performed before the merger. Correct?
That distinction can be made, Your Honor.
Okay.
To the extent that there
is a claim based solely upon the pre-merger conduct of Polymer, that claim would not be immunized, even though it may pass to Clarion in the merger. Would you agree or not? Put aside, you know, whatever post-merger conduct Clarion may be charged with.
Your Honor, there's no immunity that would pass from Polymer to Clarion. However, Section 259 also talks about the duties of the predecessor non-surviving company passing to the surviving the survivor company to the merger. And the case law that we have cited stands for the proposition that the majority view is that there is no duty of Polymer Color to an employee down the line, such as Mr. Staten, who's an employee of Clarion Corporation, and therefore under Section 259, there is no duty that could be assumed under that statute by Clarion.
Well, that may be the law of some other states, but isn't Section 259 comprehensive and universal in its provision that all assets and liabilities, which includes claims and defenses to the claims, pass from the acquired corporation to the acquirer when the acquired corporation is acquired in a merger?
A claim must be predicated upon the existence of a duty.
I'm sorry, that's a yes or no.
That's a yes, Your Honor. But a claim is dependent upon the existence of a duty that can be breached and cause damages. In this case,
why isn't there a duty? Why isn't there a duty that if you're going to transfer a piece of equipment, whether it's by merger or sale or gift, that you know is dangerous and you fail to, and in fact, is going to injure people. Why isn't there a duty to not to protect people from that circumstance?
Because the cases hold, as was the circumstance in this case, that the piece of equipment that Polymer Color utilized for a very short time was used solely for its own manufacturing processes. It was not to be put into the stream of commerce. It was not to be sold to entities as a seller would of volumes of products.
But in those cases, that really go back to the normal tort paradigm of duty, breach, proximate cause, and damages? And when you're saying no duty, that assumes that no duty precludes bringing a claim. Mr. Fletcher's position is, I have a right to sue the third-party tortfeasor that no longer exists as a result of the merger. If that alleged third-party tortfeasor wants to defend, saying, I have no duty, they can do that. But they can't stop me from bringing the lawsuit in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, that may be the case, but Mr. Staten never appealed from the dismissal of the lawsuit against Polymer Color, so they're out of this case forever. And I think that affects this case.
Well, as I understand it, the merger took place 2 years before he started working for Clarion. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And for reasons we don't understand, he didn't pick up on the merger, and he sued Polymer. So that's a whole other issue about why the case was dismissed and whether, notwithstanding the dismissal, you could have an amended complaint against Clarion. Those are all undecided issues, notwithstanding the dismissal of the case, aren't they?
They are undecided. No court has passed on the issue of whether Polymer Color owes a duty to Mr. Staten.
So that's what I'd like you to focus on for just a moment. Putting aside whether the original complaint or the amended complaint is time-barred against Polymer, and putting aside whether Polymer or its successor could defend based on no duty, no damages, no proximate cause, whatever you would bring up in a tort claim, the real question is, if you're not bringing the suit based on your status as an employee, why shouldn't you be able to bring the suit against the third party, so to speak, and then let the current employer who stands in the shoes of the third party raise whatever defenses are available?
Your Honor, I think that this court has held that that the workers' comp statute admits of only one exception, and that is an intentional tort, as I argued before this court in the Rafferty versus Hartman Walsh case. What Mr. Staton is asking the court to do is to carve out another exception to the exclusivity provisions. And I think that when you look at the rules of statutory construction, you have the workers' comp statute, which is very, very specific. It uses the words exclusive on two occasions against the more general statute, Section 259. I think that the specific always controls over the general.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's suppose two car companies merge, and we'll call them A and B. And B is the surviving company. You're an employee of B driving a car manufactured by A, and you're injured, and you attribute your injury to a defective motor vehicle that was manufactured by A. If A and B had remained distinct, the employee of B could sue A and still collect workman's compensation. If your position prevails, what you're saying is that you no longer have a cause of action, notwithstanding the fact that A manufactured the vehicle, because A no longer exists because they've been merged into your employer.
I think that's what the majority view is, Your Honor. I think that is the majority view.
Well, why is that a better view?
I think it all goes back to the purpose of the exclusivity provisions of the Workers' Comp Act, Your Honor.
Well, even the Workers' Comp Act allows for third-party claims.
I understand that, but those claims do not invade the provisions of the Workers' Comp Act that admit of no exception to the rule that an employee who is employed by an employer is bound to accept compensation from the employer for a work-based injury, which happened in this particular case. And in that instance, that's the exclusive remedy.
Well, let me try my hypothetical differently. Let's suppose you're working for Ford. And since it's a hypothetical, we can make up facts that probably wouldn't ever occur. But let's suppose, as an employee of Ford, you're driving a General Motors truck, and you're hurt on the job working for Ford. Your remedy against Ford is workman's compensation, but you could sue General Motors for the defective vehicle, couldn't you?
You could, Your Honor.
But under the rule you're advocating, if a merger takes place, your lawsuit against General Motors is no longer a possibility if Ford is the surviving corporation.
That's correct, Your Honor, because under the Workers' Comp Act, and the majority view is just that, Your Honor.
And so the effect is to extinguish a claim by merger rather than preserve it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the majority rule is not of the view that an employer's liability should be increased. I think Your Honor raised that question earlier today. I think that the cases that were cited by Mr. Staton, the Billy case, the Kismer case, and the other case that doesn't come to mind.
Curry out of Massachusetts.
All of those cases, Your Honor, are predicated upon the assumption that the plaintiff had a valid, a legally cognizable claim against the predecessor non-surviving company. The majority view is that in situations like this, the Mr. Staten would not have a valid cause of action against the non-surviving company polymer color. And because he does not have, because there is no duty, and no Delaware court has ever said there's a duty.
I understand. And that's why I use my Ford General Motors hypothetical. And the purpose of the hypothetical, although it wasn't articulated by me, was to put in the hypothetical a situation where General Motors is selling cars for everybody to use. So in General Motors, in my hypothetical, has a duty to anybody that's reasonably foreseeable to use the car. But under that hypothetical, which is distinguishable from the facts that you mentioned in this case, you said still, after the merger, there would be no cause of action against General Motors. So it doesn't turn on the fact that there was internal use contemplated within a factory. Your answer to my earlier question was it turned on the merger and the fact that the surviving entity was the employer.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's what I believe the majority view is. If you look at the Herbolzheimer,
so
and Braga.
Under that hypothetical, your position is that the effect of Section 259 is not to preserve the lawsuit originally brought against General Motors, but to extinguish it.
I think Section 2304 provides that result, Your Honor. I think that statute takes precedence over Section 259.
Under what textual reading of either 259 or 2304?
There is no... Section 2304 is very, very specific. It uses the word exclusive remedy twice. There's no...
Yes, but it does so in a context. What it's excluding are tort claims against the employer. What I'm talking about, and I think what Justice Holland's hypotheticals were talking about, were claims against the employer not... as a tortfeasor, but solely in its capacity as acquirer of the original defendant tortfeasor in a merger.
Your Honor, basically, if you look at it, I think from an objective and common sense standpoint, what is actually being alleged against Clarion Corporation is a common law tort claim, because if they assume the liabilities of the predecessor corporation, they are essentially assuming the ability to be sued under common law theories of recovery. The plaintiff has to
prove... Yes, but the party that they're suing under common law theories of recovery is the acquired corporation, which is not the employer.
Well, not anymore, Your Honor, because that claim has not been preserved in this case. The complaint was dismissed against the predecessor company, and...
I'm sorry, are you talking about this case, or are we talking about... you know, how the two statutes interact as a general matter.
Well, I mean, let's go back to this interaction.
Let's keep it general.
The interaction of the two statutes, Your Honor, I think when you look at the specific provisions of a more specific statute, 2304, they control over the more general provisions of the corporate statute.
So basically, we should read Section 259 to provide that although in a merger the assets and the liabilities of the acquired company pass to the acquiring company, that is the surviving corporation, that is not the case where the liability happens to be a tort lawsuit by an employee of the acquiring corporation.
Yes, Your Honor.
In that case, the immunity created by 2304 creates an exception under 259, even though 259 doesn't say that, and neither does 2304.
neither say that, Your Honor, but I think 2304, when you look at it closely.
I mean, it explicitly says that.
Not explicitly, although I think when when you look at the definition of an exclusive in a very specific statute such as 2304, that prevails and controls over the more general language of 259.
Can I ask you a question? I want to understand the point of your argument about that Polymer has been dismissed. Are you saying that even if we accept Mr. Fletcher's argument as to what the law is, the dismissal somehow precludes the claim in this case? Because it's a raised judicata?
No, I don't, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that.
What was the reason the case against Polymer was dismissed?
Because the Superior Court held, I think perhaps incorrectly, that the claim against it was barred by the exclusivity provisions of the Workers' Comp Act. And that was never appealed, despite the fact that Mr. Staten was never an employee of Polymer Color.
So tell me what should have been done to preserve that, because if Clariant's the successor to Polymer, and just tell me what should have been done.
But you know, I don't know that the dismissal of Polymer Color is a key issue in this case. I acknowledge that.
Great. Okay, then that's fine.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and we'll have a brief recess.